Welcome to the Morning Magazine for Friday, December 9th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, how will Boulderites of the future look back on what life was like during the pandemic? They may refer to a compilation of stories in a book that's being presented tonight. We'll speak with the author. We'll then hear about efforts to bury overhead power lines in wildfire-prone areas. Then we'll go to Sports Talk, our weekly regional sports roundup. And then we'll hear from .org, our spotlight on local nonprofits. At the bottom of the hour, Connections comes your way with this week's host, Duncan Campbell. Then at 9:30, Meredith Carson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Jack Armstrong.
Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser is urging a Washington state court judge to block Albertsons' $4 billion payout to its investors while the company's merger with Kroger is under review. Weiser's office is leading a multi-state investigation of proposed grocery chain mergers. Kroger announced its plans to acquire Albertsons for $25 billion in mid-October. Speaking at a press conference on Thursday, Weiser said the merger, if approved, could result in higher prices for Colorado consumers, lower wages for workers, fewer jobs, and negatively impact farmers and those in rural communities.
It is not plausible to tell someone in Cortez, oh, you could drive to Grand Junction for an alternative supermarket. That's just not plausible. And we are very mindful of those concerns, and we are going to be making sure to hear directly from those who will be affected by this merger.
Colorado has nearly 150 Kroger stores branded as either King Supers or City Market, and around 100 Albertsons-owned stores, usually doing business as Safeway. Weiser said that in many communities in the state, these stores are competing head-to-head, and in some communities, they are the only grocery stores serving residents.
Now, this merger, because of the market shares, has the real prospect of adversely affecting rural, urban, including food deserts, which can be in rural or urban areas. So we're really concerned in both contexts, what will happen, what will be the consequences, and how do we make sure to protect all communities in Colorado.
Weiser also said he plans to go on a statewide tour of Colorado in order to hear directly from consumers on this issue. He said he has already heard from Coloradans concerned about the impact of the merger.
To give you a sense of the concerns, I want to read from a card that someone shared with us from one from Estes Park. Please do all you can to prevent a grocery monopoly. Our Safeway is already the highest priced store in the chain due to our seasonal tourist season. If Albertsons and Kroger's merge, it will only get worse.
The State Attorney General's office is accepting public comments on the proposed merger through the website stopfraudcolorado.gov. Denver officials told reporters during a Thursday press conference that they are not seeing any evidence of another government entity directing migrants to Denver. The city held yesterday's press conference to address speculation and questions surrounding a 120-person spike of immigrants arriving in Denver by bus earlier in the week, and the city deploying a makeshift shelter at a rec center in response to the flux. Denver's Deputy Chief of Staff Evan Dreyer said people staying at the shelter told the workers they organized on social media to come to Denver. City officials say they are still trying to find out details about the bus or buses that brought the migrants to Denver and their point of origin, as well as trying to understand why Denver is a destination for the migrants. City officials say they expect more migrants may arrive in the coming days. The El Paso County District Court judge presiding over the Club Q case unsealed documents yesterday related to the prior arrest of the alleged shooter. Police arrested the suspect, Anderson Lee Aldrich, whose current defense attorneys claim goes by the pronouns they/them and is non-binary, in June 2021, following allegations of a bomb threat and threatening to kill their grandparents, who had also called 911. Unsealed records showed that during the 2021 SWAT team arrest, law enforcement found and seized guns and rounds of ammunition, a gas mask, body armor, and a tub full of chemicals to make explosive materials. Allen said authorities did not return the seized weapons to Aldrich, despite Aldrich's attempts to reclaim the guns. During the 2021 case, other distant relatives submitted statements to the court warning Eldrick would harm their grandparents again and should remain incarcerated. El Paso County District Attorney Michael Allen told the Associated Press yesterday the court dismissed the 2021 case after the suspect's mother and grandparents evaded subpoenas that would have required them to testify in court against their relative. The United States Congress passed the Respect for Marriage Act Thursday. The landmark legislation creates explicit federal protections for interracial and same-sex marriage. Congressperson Joe Neguse of Colorado's 2nd District said in a statement, quote, "This moment holds particular importance to our community. Thanks to the late Clara Roicks, Boulder County's former county clerk, Clara was a champion for equality, and in 1975 made history as the first county clerk in the nation to issue a marriage license to a same-sex couple, transforming the lives of countless families across the country." Colorado Governor Jared Polis joined White House officials yesterday by announcing that the United States Department of Treasury has approved Colorado's use around $170 million in federal American Rescue Plan Act funds to help build broadband infrastructure within the state. State officials plan on distributing the funds to internet services providers through a competitive grant program that will require the building of broadband projects within the areas of state with no or limited high-speed internet. Polis and his administration also announced yesterday the National Telecommunications Information Administration will award Colorado over $5 million to expand the internet access, affordability, and digital skills for the state's residents. In October, the Polis administration announced a 5-year plan that aims to connect 99% of Colorado households with high-speed internet. The Colorado Energy Office announced a draft plan Thursday aiming to boost sales and use of electric vehicles in the state. According to the Denver Post, objectives of the plan include electrifying a bigger share of medium and heavy-duty trucks and buses and boosting electric passenger vehicles to 25% of the market share by 2025, as well as having all vehicles on the road be electric by 2050. Thursday's announcement is the second update to the state's plan, which the agency's director says is a response to a remarkable acceleration in Colorado EV sales. The Energy Office is also considering offering state incentives to offset restrictions on the $7,500 federal tax credit under the Inflation Reduction Act. Boulder councilperson Junie Joseph says that she will stay on as a city council member, while also heading into her newly elected position as state representative for House District 10. Joseph won the House District seat in November and says she's now plans on serving the rest of her city council term that ends in November 2023. Joseph told Boulder Beat News earlier the week that she thought resigning her city council post would leave a big hole and that she wanted to honor the voter mandate of a 4-year term. According to the Boulder Beat News, Joseph initially planned on resigning from her city council post shortly after the November election, but reconsidered after learning nothing in the city code or state law would prevent her from serving both bodies. For today's weather, the National Weather Service is predicting sunny skies with temperatures in the 40s. Tonight, skies will be clear with breezy winds and lows in the upper teens / lows 20s. The current temperature in Boulder is 23 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. The COVID-19 pandemic has become a shared experience that will mark the lives of those who live through it. And while the virus is still very much around, it no longer occupies the sort of front-of-mind space that it did 2 years ago. So what do we do to document history in the making? How will we describe this time to future generations? These are questions Carolyn Kirchhoff has been answering with her work on the project she calls Boulder COVID Stories. She collected testimonies from the pandemic during 2020 and 2021 and compiled some of the more noteworthy impressions into a book she'll be presenting tonight at 7 p.m. at East Window, a new art gallery in North Boulder. Carolyn Kirchhoff joins me now over Zoom. Good morning.
Good morning, Shannon. Thanks so much for having me.
Start off by describing the Boulder COVID Stories project in your own words, and how did it start?
The project really started when I began conducting informal interviews in parks and other public spaces in Boulder in the summer of 2020. I had just moved to Boulder in March of 2020, 9 days before the pandemic started, and it was, for me personally, a pretty difficult time, and it was pretty isolating. For example, my husband and I got married that summer. We had to do it on Zoom. And so the Boulder COVID Stories Project was my attempt to connect with the Boulder community and process what was happening for myself. And I got the idea just because the parks were the only safe spaces during the pandemic. They were the only spaces where we could meet and talk. And so I set up what I called the office in the park, which was two chairs, some hand sanitizer, a box of masks. And then people walked by and asked me what I was up to. And I explained that I was conducting informal interviews about what they were experiencing during the pandemic. I didn't record the interviews. They were really free flowing, and I let the interviewees direct the conversation. And I learned so much about Boulder, and I really feel like this is the project that helped me connect with my community at a pretty difficult time. And it was a time that was about so many different things, and COVID-19 was really only one of them. There was a lot of personal and political upheaval happening. The Black Lives Matter protests, for example, the presidential campaign, the January 6th attack on the Capitol, the attack at the King Soopers grocery store, and then vaccines and the challenges of resuming quote unquote normal life. And all of these moments are present in the interviews that I conducted at my office in the park.
About how many people did you speak with over the course of your office hours in the park?
I spoke to a total of 75 people from all different walks of life. It was really my privilege to speak to all of these Boulderites and also a few visitors. And unfortunately, only a fraction of the people I spoke with appear in the Boulder COVID Stories book. But I'm so thankful to every single person who stopped by the park and spent their time and opened up to me.
And you and I know this, but listeners may not know this, but I actually talked to you in the park shortly after I arrived in Boulder. Like you, I was a recent arrival due to the pandemic. I, you know, couldn't live where I had been living with my family for many years and ended up here. What were some of the common themes or experiences that kept emerging over the course of your conversations?
People had a wide variety of experiences. A lot of people were having a really difficult time, much more difficult than I was. And a lot of people struggled with COVID-19 as an illness. A lot of people struggled with job loss or stress in their relationships or just financial turmoil. Some people had lost their homes. And then on the other extreme, a lot of the people I talked to were actually having a really good year. Some of the people I talked to said, like, yeah, business has never been better, and I feel like we really have time to ourselves. I think some people who were maybe overcommitted before the pandemic started enjoyed being able to take a step back from all of these obligations.
Were there any stories in particular that really stood out? Or maybe even if you'd like to read a section of your book, I invite you to do so.
There are so many stories that stand out. I talked to, for example, a woman. She was a veteran, and she had gone through a divorce shortly before the pandemic. And she had started online dating right at the beginning of the pandemic. And then I spoke to her the day before the man flew out to Boulder to meet her. That was so exciting. And yeah, I would love to read a passage to you. So I started conducting interviews at North Boulder Park. And then after I had gotten a few sessions under my belt, I decided to mix it up and start going to other parks. And this paragraph is from a chapter that is set at Eben G. Fine Park. So it's a very popular park with visitors to Boulder in particular. In this paragraph, I kind of explain the office dynamic. Being lonely is like carrying a full pot of soup around. If I bump into someone, if a neighbor in my apartment building asks me how I'm doing, for example, it slops over the sides. I'm uncontained. I tell them too much. It makes people uncomfortable. Or maybe it doesn't, but at any rate, the people who visit the office in the park don't want to hear about it. Even the people who ask me about me tune out my answers and look off into the distance anxiously, distractedly. At the office, the roles are clearly defined. They're here to tell their stories. I'm here to listen.
So you moved here at the start of the pandemic, and now you have plans to move away. What is the significance of you leaving this testimonial here and presenting it in public tonight?
So this book is really my story braided together with the stories that people told me at the parks, and then also my observations about Boulder as a city. So I feel like being able to present this book right before I leave Boulder is my opportunity to just share what I experienced here. And I'm really thankful to East Window, a brand new gallery in North Boulder, for hosting me tonight at 7 p.m. I'll be holding a short reading from the Boulder COVID Stories book and a discussion afterwards about community and creating spaces for connection and ultimately social change. The exhibit at East Window right now is incredible. I'm so excited to be able to read in this amazing space. It's showing photographs by Evans Alex Santil. Entry is free.
Boulder COVID Stories, Notes from the Pandemic, tonight at the East Window Art Gallery in North Boulder at 7 p.m. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much. I hope to see you there.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. We'll be right back. It's been nearly a year since the Marshall Fire destroyed over 1,000 homes in Boulder County. Late last month, a judge overruled Xcel Energy's motion to dismiss a lawsuit seeking damages from the energy company. Boulder County investigators have not yet announced what caused the fire. Investigators have previously said they are looking into human activity, as well as the possibility of an underground fire at a former coal mine. Some of the first reports about the fire blamed sparks from a power line downed by strong winds. Xcel has argued that it has not seen evidence that its equipment caused the fire. Regardless, some say the only strong argument against burying power lines in wildfire-prone areas is financial. Eric Galatis has more.
The nation is beefing up its power grids for the transition to fueling everything from cars to home cooling systems with electricity and addressing hazards along the way. Engineers say they're ready to implement a common-sense solution for stopping the sparks from power lines that have led to destructive wildfires, including the one that burned down the entire town of Paradise, California. Paul Schanowski with the climate consulting firm Resilient Analytics says burying distribution lines underground would essentially eliminate the risk of sparks. Wildfires.
Most people would agree that we're doing it when other countries are. Bottom line, cost. Who's going to pay for it?
Schanowski calls President Joe Biden's infrastructure legislation a good start, but with the price of undergrounding power lines at $4 million per mile or more, much more will be needed to reconfigure power distribution, especially across vast expanses in Colorado and other western states. Schanowski points to successful federal efforts that brought electricity to rural America for the first time in the 1930s as one potential way forward. He says the cost of damage from wildfires, lost homes and other structures, the health impacts of dangerous air quality, and the long-term impacts on watersheds far outweighs any upfront investment to move power lines underground.
The Marshall Fire, that was a huge event. It's not going to be the last one. There is no question that the investment long term will be less than the amount we would pay in rebuilding after disaster events.
According to state officials, Colorado's core fire seasons are 78 days longer on average than they were in the 1970s, a situation made more dire by rising temperatures, prolonged drought, and blasting winds. Schanowski says what gets lost in hyper-partisan debates around infrastructure investments is the fact that power lines can spark wildfires in any neighborhood, regardless of political affiliation.
We lose the focus that this is ultimately a public safety issue, and we're talking about trying to save people's lives. We need to focus on that again.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
We go now to our weekly sports roundup with Jimmy Searfoss.
There's currently a sickness going around in the KGNU offices, but don't worry. The only sick thing on this show is Sports Talk with Jimmy. Hello and welcome back to Sports Talk with Jimmy. I am your host, Jimmy Searfoss, back again with another episode on the best sports show on KGNU Sports Talk with Jimmy. And Boulder, Colorado has been the site for sports in the last 2 weeks. And that held up last night when the Colorado Buffaloes took on the Colorado State Rams in a basketball game that led to Colorado winning by the largest margin of victory since World War II. Last night, over 10,000 people attended CU's victory over the CSU Rams 93-65. It was one of the biggest CU basketball games in the last few years. And we've talked a little bit about rivalries that Colorado has. We talked about Nebraska earlier on in the year when their basketball team played a scrimmage against ours. And that rivalry with Nebraska is old, but no rivalry goes back further than Colorado State. Colorado State, of course, is located north of the University of Colorado and is in Fort Collins. Their mascot is Cam the Ram, similar to Ralphie, but it's a ram and they run it out on the field before football games. As you guys know, the rivalry is titled the Rocky Mountain Showdown, and it dates all the way back to 1893. When they play in football, the winning team holds the Centennial Cup to commemorate the victory. There is no trophy for men and women's basketball games, but the volleyball team shares the golden spike that goes to whoever wins that game. Both teams did play each other multiple times in volleyball this year. Colorado State managed to take the first game, but Colorado came back the second game, which was the next night, and took that spike right back. It's not really close when it comes to the all-time series in volleyball, though. Colorado State is up. Colorado State has 9 more victories over CU in the all-time records, 26-17. Football and basketball is a different story, though. Colorado holds a firm lead in the all-time football record with 67 wins and 22 losses. In men's basketball, the Buffs dominate the all-time record with 93 wins and 40 losses. And the same goes for women, who have 39-12 record against Colorado State. But in reality, this rivalry is rooted in football. The two teams used to play each other at the Denver Broncos Stadium, but that rivalry is making its way to Boulder in 2023 when the Rams come down to Boulder to play Colorado. And that game's going to be crazy, especially with the new Colorado head coach, Deion Sanders. I wouldn't be surprised if they break attendance records for it. The rivalry divides families in Colorado. I know for sure it divides mine. I have plenty of family that has gone to CU, that has gone to CSU. I got friends that have gone to CSU, and nothing is more exciting than getting the opportunity to just talk some trash with them, especially when the Colorado Buffaloes manage to pull out a win. And that is just about all I've got for you today here on Sports Talk with Jimmy. Make sure you tune in next week at this same time for the next episode of Sports Talk here on KGNU.
Welcome to .org, KGNU's weekly look at local nonprofits.
So here is protein 2. This okay. is protein 2. This is going to be your beans and your peanut butter.
Okay.
Again, 1 point for the beans unless it says 2, and then you have your peanut butter.
The volunteers and staff at Community Table and our Arvada-based food pantry are busy these days helping and guiding a steady stream of families and individuals, including seniors, who are filling up their carts with food. At its core, Community Table provides free and emergency food assistance, primarily to Jefferson County residents, but also to other metro area clientele who are experiencing hunger and food insecurity. The 40-year-old organization also strives to help those challenged by poverty in other ways, such as an on-site health clinic, financial assistance for rent and utility payments, and showers and laundry service for those without a home.
We're down food, but we're up clients.
That's Sandy Martin, President and Chief Executive Officer of Community Table, explaining the needs that she and the organization's volunteers are seeing these days.
In September of 2021, we saw 1,600 folks come through our doors. This same time this year for 2022, that's been 3,250 people. So it's more than doubled. We have just been heavily impacted. Needs going up, supplies going down.
On November 14th, at the start of the National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week, Community Table launched its 25 by 25 community-wide food drive to collect 25,000 pounds of food by December 25th. Community Table's Sandy Martin explains more about the help they and other food pantries are needing.
We would just ask if you could, when you go to the store, pick up a couple extra cans of corn or green beans or applesauce and bring those to one of our food barrels or to Co-Table or to your pantries that you are in your community to see if you can help out, because this pandemic was a real game changer. And then with this, you know, supply shortages and now this recession that we're finding ourselves in, it's been really tough to feed people, and we could use everyone's help. And our communities have been so generous, and we're just asking again, if you can help us out.
For more information about Community Table, its current food drive, and the services the organization provides, Sandy Martin urges listeners to go to their website at cotable.org and the organization's social media sites of Instagram and Twitter. For KGNU.org, I'm Stacey Johnson.
You've been listening to .org, KGNU's weekly look at local nonprofits. For more .orgs or for more information on this episode, visit news.kgnu.org.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Thanks to Stacey Johnson, Jack Armstrong, Maeve Conran, and Jimmy Searfoss for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for Connections. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC.